All right, thank you very much. Let me also wish you a happy Mother's Day. There are gifts that I see back there that has been prepared by events team. Thank you, events team, for doing that. Those are for all the moms-to-be, so make sure you pick one up. If you are a husband, you're here by yourself, your wife is not here, make sure you pick one up for them as well. All right, so we're going to do that. And then also on your bulletin, you have three different dates this summer, beginning with June 21st, and then there's one in July and August as well. And as Sandy mentioned, a number of you guys joined our church family through those picnic services. And so please take advantage of those times to invite anyone and everyone. We'll have plenty of food, so make sure you invite people for that, okay? But I wanted to start us off with a quick video celebrating Mother's Day, all right? So let's see if this will work on our first try. Here it goes.
Chemistry lab.
No, you did not.
It's a long story.
Okay.
How was choir?
It was good.
Moms have it so easy. I mean, their lives are fun, simple, and so rewarding. Sometimes I wish, instead of being the dad, I wish I was the mom. Another day of pedicures, reading my magazines, and making myself beautiful. This is the life.
Mom? Mom, tell him to stop copying me.
Mom, tell him to stop copying me.
I'm not kidding.
I'm not kidding.
Mom, do something.
Mom, do something.
Are you serious?
Are you serious?
Mom, are you serious? Why did I ever ask you to help me? I should have known you couldn't fix my hair. I look like a freak. Look at me.
Look at me. Hey, Mom. Look at this. Look at me. Come on, Mom. Look at me. Watch this, Mom. Come on. Look at this. Watch this. Mom, look at me. Come on, Mom. Look at me. Come on, Mom. Look at me. Come on. Mom, I have a book report due tomorrow, and I haven't read any of this.
Mom, if you don't help me, I'm gonna fail school and be a loser forever.
You don't expect me to read this all by myself, do you? You don't expect me to eat this, do you?
Seriously, Mom, what is this?
Mom, I'm not gonna eat this.
Dad, can we just go out to eat, please?
Hey, kids, be nice to your mother.
If I eat this, I'm gonna throw up.
Mom, I said I'm gonna throw up.
Mom, I think I'm gonna be sick too.
You're amazing. No, seriously. I don't know how you do it. I'm at a loss for words. Kids, come here. Get in here. Hug your mother. Tell her you love her. We're in the presence of greatness.
Dad.
Not now. Dad's on a roll. This is God's greatest creation, kids.
You're smushing my face.
Sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And I'm sorry. Because I don't say thank you enough. I mean, the truth is, I don't deserve you. We don't deserve you. And one day is not enough to honor you. We should honor you every day. But how do we say thank you to the woman that means the world to us? I know. We're gonna go right now and get you that vacuum cleaner you've had your eye on. Don't speak. This time, we're going name brand, baby. Come on, kids. Let's go make your mom's dreams come true.
All right, just a quick silly video showing us that our moms are amazing and they're the greatest gift, amen? And that you would take this day, and not just this day, but other days to thank them, to recognize them for all that they do, for your families and for this church family as well. We're so grateful for our moms, and I hope that today will be a day that you feel blessed as well. We began this day at 10:30 praying for our moms. And so hope you feel the prayers that we give to you. I was thinking of what to do in terms of a Mother's Day message. And what I wanted to do was actually, because in a few weeks, we're celebrating Father's Day and we'll be at a picnic, right? The second Sunday of June, some people recognize that as Children's Day. All right. So within this like a month period, you got Mother's Day, you got Children's Day, you got Father's Day. So what I thought I'd do is I'll combine all those days and do a message about a family from scriptures that I think we'll find a lot of things that we can relate to. I was trying to do this, the story of one family's journey, Isaac, Rebecca, Esau, and Jacob's journey in one sermon. I couldn't do that. It actually could have been like a three-part series, but I'm going to make it a mini two-part series. So I won't be able to finish the story today. I'll finish it next Sunday, but I'll do the best that I can in terms of getting as far along as I can into this story. I chose the story because we learn so much about each of these characters. There's so much depth that this story shares with us from Genesis. And it's also a family that maybe we can relate to more, beginning with the size of this family. Unusual by ancient standards, but this family of four would have fit right into today's standards. In the U.S., the average family has 2.06 children, all right? I don't know where the 06 comes from, okay, but 2.06 children. And so this family would have fit right into today's culture. The family that we'll study today, there's a dad, there's a mom, there's two boys. Sounds very familiar to me and to a number of you guys as well. It was a journey of Isaac, Rebecca, their twin boys, Esau and Jacob. And in fact, even except for Esau's name, even their names will fit right in, right? Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, you see those names. I think there's a reason why we don't hear Esau's name as much as well, okay? I think everyone will find something in this family's journey as we talk about it that you'll be able to relate to. Whether as a son or daughter, as a sibling, as a parent, or as a spouse, all right? It starts from Genesis 24, so you could turn there because we're going to be camping out in chapter 24, 25, 26 for the rest of today, and then we'll finish the story next week. All right, so Genesis chapter 24. I'm going to go off mostly from the ESV version, although I'll be mixing in the NIV version as well, but you could go ahead and turn there from Genesis chapter 24. The story of this family actually does not begin with Isaac or Rebecca. It begins with his father, Abraham, and his most trusted servant. This is how the story starts. Now, Abraham was old, well advanced in years, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. And Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he had, put your hand under my thigh. That image will be weird to us now, but it spoke about a solemn oath that was being taken. Put your hand under my thigh that I may make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell, but will go to my country and to my kindred and take a wife for my son Isaac. So here's Abraham getting older and weaker. God's blessed him in all things, but there's one remaining thing that has not happened that he wants to see happen before his death, and it's that his son Isaac get married. So much so that he makes his most trusted servant make this solemn oath. Again, putting one's hand under the thigh could have several different meanings, including symbolizing you're under one's authority. Or it could actually be translated not thigh, but loins. And something to do with posterity. And but regardless of what exactly that phrase means, someone said that it would be equivalent of putting your hand on a Bible and making that oath. But regardless, it was a very, very serious oath. This is a very, very serious thing for Abraham, that he ensures that his son Isaac gets married off, but not just to any kind of person or any kind of woman. He gives specific instructions. One is, it cannot be from the daughters of the Canaanites. By this, he's not saying that she can't be from a different culture, but rather of a different faith, a different God. He wants someone for his son Isaac of the same faith and convictions. And to ensure this, he sends his servant to his kindred from his home country. Now you could ask, why doesn't Abraham do it himself? Well, it's a place that he himself cannot return to because not only of his age, we don't know when he'll die, but because of his own faith journey. If you remember his faith journey, that's the place that he left in obedience to God. He cannot return there. He cannot be buried there. So while he's got to stay here, he sends his servant, go find a wife who will have the same faith, same convictions. But there's another part to this promise. Not only someone, or this criteria, not only someone of the same faith, but someone who will trust God enough to do what he did many years ago, to leave her country, to leave everything, just like Abraham did, and come back with this man. So someone of the same faith, same convictions, someone who has this kind of trust and a relationship with God, to trust in leaving everything and following the Lord's calling. Abraham has high standards for his son. The servant wonders in verse 5, what if I find that woman of the same faith from your hometown, from your home country, but is unwilling to come back with me to this land? The servant, he thinks that's highly unlikely. Who would leave everything? Who would leave everything to follow a stranger to a strange country to marry a total stranger? That's a hard sell. And Abraham says, if she won't come with you, you're released from your vow. But I cannot have Isaac marry a Canaanite, and I can't have him leave and go back to his home. He has to stay here. This is God's calling. And so I imagine Abraham, the father, praying and trusting. After all, remember, this family is not just any ordinary family in the sense that God has promised Abraham through him and through his seed, many nations will come. That will be a blessing to all nations. And without Isaac having a wife, no children, without children, no chance of becoming that nation. But he knows he cannot compromise on his son's behalf the kind of woman she is to marry. Abraham feels, I hope you see this already, the burden, the final burden and responsibility. And this is the burden for any godly parent, any believing parent. Some of you young families, parents, you've already begun praying for your young child's future spouse. That's a good thing. We should be already praying for the future because we know that they'll be with us for a few years, but most of their life will be lived with this spouse. And so we already begin praying, and we should get specific in our prayers, even as Abraham was very specific in what he wanted to see. Some of you guys have been praying for many years as your children are now coming of age. Some of you, those who are single, I was actually hoping that there were a lot more singles here today, okay? Because a lot of this message will actually be geared towards them. And so I'm going to make sure that they listen to this message online. But some of you have godly parents, believing parents, who've been praying for you and your future marriage. From about 25, which is when I graduated seminary, right around there, my dad, godly, believing dad and mom, they would constantly get on me about marriage. Some of you guys have experienced that, right? They try to send me on these dates, and I would obediently go on some of these dates, some of the most awkward dates imaginable. There's one particular one that still makes me cringe as I thought about it, where this blind date, where I don't know why I agreed to this, where my parents and her parents came along to on this blind date. At the end of this date, her father asked if I would get her number. It was the most awkward thing. What I could not appreciate then was how burdened my dad felt that this would be his final response. He's raised me, he's cared for me, he's provided for me, and this would be the final thing. That's how he took it. That he will find a woman of faith, of character, and then he'll be done with me. Right? Pass me along. For much younger than 25, my dad, the one thing he would always emphasize to me was, and not necessarily the case for everyone, but my dad, he would always emphasize, you gotta find someone from a godly home. And it was never about the kind of girl, even. It was always what kind of home she comes from, a godly home, a godly home. And he would always, and in my youth, I'd be like, no, what are we talking about? And now that God has answered his prayer, and I'm married into a godly home, I am so grateful for his prayers and his wisdom, which I disregarded when younger. When I think about Lydia's home that I married into, my in-laws who've been such a blessing for our marriage and our ministry, my father-in-law who was an elder, he was actually thrilled for Lydia to be marrying a pastor. Who does that? Who gets thrilled that their daughter's being married to a pastor? That doesn't happen. You reluctantly say yes to that, right? But he was thrilled that that would be the case. And to have, as we planted this church, all of our siblings be part of this church plant, I wanted to make sure, and I checked in with each and every one of them, that they themselves were praying and felt convicted about this. I didn't want it to be a case where, because I'm planting a church, all the family members have to come, right, out of obligation. And each of them on their own said, we want to be part of this. We believe in the vision, and each of them are serving. And so when I married Lydia, I married into so much more than just Lydia. And I see the wisdom of what my dad was constantly getting on me about. And that was his prayer for me. If you have godly parents, you too will one day appreciate their prayers and their wisdom. Their word that now may sound like, oh, it's just ranting, but you will see the wisdom and you will see the heart behind it. Not to say that your parents are perfect, but no one has your best interest like your parents. And they see this as their final responsibility, just like Abraham. If your parents, if you're single and your parents are not believers, and you don't get that prayer and that wisdom from them, as I shared last Sunday, you are part of a bigger family now. Just like I said last Sunday, for those of you who are the only believer in your family, hey, you have us as your family. Here is your family. You could find so much wisdom, spiritual mentors, moms and dads, those who've gone before you. Find a few people here. Ask for their prayers for your marriage, for your future. Ask them questions. Gain wisdom. Some of you guys might think, oh man, everyone here seems so busy, which is probably true. But to think in any way, there's somebody you find in our church family that you would love to learn from. I'll bet you, if you were to ask them, they will not feel this as a burden. They'll be honored by that. They'll be honored that someone, a young person, will come and ask for their prayers, seek out their wisdom. I remember when Lydia and I were getting married, right? And in the church that I was serving at, because I was a youth pastor, there was no one that I could really ask. And I remember I sought out a couple of couples, one particular couple, who in the community, I got to know, it was a deacon of another church in a community. He was well in his 70s, I believe. And I remember spending time with him, asking him questions about, tell me about marriage. And he gave me the best advice I've ever received about marriage. Let me tell you. He said, every day hold your hands and pray together. And that has never left. That's the one consistent thing that we've always been able to do all these years. And you've heard me say this over and over again, right? Those who've gone through premarital counseling with me, I've said this over and over again. I got it from this gentleman and his wife, who I saw them loving each other so well, gaining their wisdom. And they were honored that I would ask. And ask the people within this church. If anyone you ask says no to you, and they say they're too busy, come talk to me, okay? There's an issue there, all right? But I guarantee they'll be honored if you would do so. seeking out prayer and wisdom. Well, as we'll see, Abraham got to see the fruit of his prayers. Like my dad is getting to see the fruit of his prayers. A family, a whole family so supportive of this church plan, of this ministry, of our marriage. Abraham got to see it as an incredible woman of character and godliness appears. Imagine Abraham's joy on that wedding day. Isaac, years later, when he becomes a father and he has a child now that's of age to get married, he experiences the opposite of what his dad Abraham experienced. A quick fast forward and we'll come back to the story. Genesis 26, when Esau was 40 years old, he took Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, to be his wife, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and they made life bitter for Isaac and Rebekah. Here's the opposite spectrum. I'm sure Isaac, like Abraham, prayed for his first son, gave him wisdom upon wisdom, saying, that's the wrong way to go, that's the wrong way to go. But Esau, disregarding all the parents' plea and wisdom and prayers, makes his own choice in marriage. And bitterness, hardship, pain, as Isaac and Rebekah witnesses this, marrying outside of faith, outside of conviction, outside of the character. I imagine many godly parents, you know, speaking wisdom to their children, praying for their children, but ultimately it's their children's choice, walking away in disobedience and disregard. We got these two, in this one family, we got these two spectrum, Abraham and Isaac listening and waiting for God's provision, and then Esau just disregarding and doing what he wants. Back to our story. Okay, there's a lot of, as we go through the story, there's a lot of just cool lessons we learn from this. So Abraham's servant has this task, right? And he finally goes and he gets there to Abraham's old home country. He's resting by a well. He's here. But now what? Where does he even start? Well, if you don't know where to start, you do what he did. He starts with prayer. And this is what he prays, a very specific prayer. Let the young woman, he's talking to God here, let the young woman to whom I shall say, please let down your jar that I may drink. And who shall say, drink and I will water your camels. Let her be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. By this I shall know that you have shown steadfast love to my master. So he has this request. Let this be the response of this woman. But if you think about it, on the one hand, it would actually have been expected that if a stranger asked someone for water, that they would actually give water. This was actually expected in a culture that was high in hospitality. I mean, in our culture, that's not high in hospitality. Stranger walks by, they're dying of thirst, we would give them water. What is it about this that sets this woman apart? It says, she will say, here's your drink, and I will water your camels. I will water your camels. In his mind, that will set her apart from everyone else, watering his camels, set her apart from everyone else, and show her compassion, her generosity, her character. Why? Do you know how much water a camel's drink of water? Camels can drink up to 30 to 40 gallons of water in one session. And we're told in verse 10, this guy had 10 camels. That's 300 to 400 gallons of water. That's a lot of water and a lot of work. Whoever is willing to do that must be a woman of incredible generosity and character. And so this is going to be his test. Verse 15, before he had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah. God answers immediately. Rebecca comes along. He asks her for water. And she says, drink, my Lord. And she quickly let down her jar upon her hand and gave him a drink. When she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw water for your camels also. Ding, 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 ding. We have a winner here, right? Until they have finished drinking. That would have been a long time. That is a lot of water. So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran again to the well to draw water. And she ran again and 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 again. She drew for all his camels. Why he has 10 camels, I have no idea, okay? But he drew for all 10 camels. Verse 21, the man gazed at her in silence to learn whether the Lord has prospered his journey or not. She's busy going back and forth, but getting water. And all he can do is just stare. just stare. Why is he staring so intently? In verse 16, it tells us that Rebecca was a very attractive young woman. So is that why? Here's this creepy old man staring at this young, beautiful woman working, slaving away for him, right? Is that why he's staring? No, it's probably because he can't believe his eyes. Can there be a woman like this? Huh? So generous, so kind to a total stranger. This must be the one that God has forgot to answer so quickly. Well, actually, it was Abraham's prayer, I believe, that for years have been praying, and I think Isaac as well, that God has now answered this woman, this incredible woman of character. So he witnesses her generosity and character. He then witnesses the kind of faith she has. He meets her family, who just happened to be the relatives of Abraham, his master, and then tells them excitedly about who sent him, why he's here, what he prayed, and then how Rebecca came along and did exactly what he prayed for. She is clearly the one that God has chosen for my master's son. He can't wait to go back with her. But will she go with a stranger to a strange land to marry a total stranger? Verse 57, they said, "Let us call the young woman, ask her." And they called Rebecca and said to her, "Will you go with this man?" And she said, "I will go. I will go." That's the very answer that her future father-in-law, Abraham, said when God called him in that same place many years ago, "Go and leave your family and I will show you where to go." And he simply says, "I will go." The difference, of course, is Abraham went with his wife. He had family. She will be going all on her own. Rebecca is in a line of godly women in the Bible whose response to God is simple and filled with trust. Like Esther, when God reveals his plan for her, she says, "If I perish, I perish." Like Mary, who when God reveals his plan to her, she says, "May it be to me as you have said." Here is Rebecca, when God reveals his plan to her, she says, "I will go. I will go." Now the servant knows, without a shadow of doubt, God has indeed blessed beyond his imagination. This beautiful young woman with incredible faith, incredible trust in God, and incredible character. I spent some time painting a picture of Rebecca's character right now because later in the story, we'll get to next week, we'll begin to wonder and question her character. So it's important that you have this picture of the kind of woman Rebecca is in mind for now, okay? As we fast forward. Verse 61, "Then Rebecca and her maids got ready, mounted their camels, went back with the man. So the servant took Rebecca and left. Now Isaac had come down from Beer Lahai Roy, for he was living in the Negev. He went out to the field one evening to meditate. As he looked up, he saw camels approaching." We now meet Isaac as he's coming down from a time of meditation. That's a hard Hebrew word to translate. Probably, I think it refers to a time of prayer and of worship. He was spending time with God, accentuating the fact we know already of Isaac's character and faith. He's a man of character, a man of faith. In the story of Isaac being sacrificed by Abraham, so much credit, rightly so, goes to Abraham. Look at this man of faith who was willing to kill his only son for the sake of obedience to God. Sacrifice his only son for the sake of obedience to God. What faith did Abraham have? Believing that God could resurrect Isaac. And so we think about Isaac. We think about Abraham, right, and his faith. But Isaac was the one being sacrificed. And he was not a toddler who had no idea of what's going on. Abraham put the wood for the sacrifice on his back. Would you do that to a five-year-old? You know, you carry this, right? No. Most likely, Isaac, the English word is lad. Most likely, Isaac was in his teens or 20s. Some think even in his 30s. And Isaac knows exactly about this whole ritual because he asks Abraham, "Dad, where is the sacrifice? We have everything else for the sacrifice. Where is the sacrifice?" At some point, Abraham must have told Isaac, "Son, you are." And Isaac allows his dad to strap him down on that sacrifice. And so while we look at Abraham and say, wow, amazing faith, I look at Isaac and say, wow, amazing trust. Just as Christ hung on that cross as the Father willed it, he's there being willing to be sacrificed as a father, both Abraham and God wills it. So here are two people, Isaac and Rebekah. Same faith, same convictions, same character, same trust in God. And now they will lay eyes on each other for the first time. He looks up, he sees camels approaching. What is this? Verse 64, Rebekah also looked up and saw Isaac. The two eyes gazed. Was it love at first sight? She got down from her camel and asked the servant, "Who is that man in the field coming to meet us?" "He is my master," the servant answered. So she took her veil and covered herself. One thing about reading the Bible, right? I love reading stories, right? And I love imagining tone. And so imagine, I wonder, how did she say this? Was she like, "That's the man? Who is that man? That's the man I left everything for?" Or, "Who is that man?" You know, with just eyes just glittering. Even more better than I thought, okay? I think it was latter, okay? I think he looks up, she looks up, their eyes meet, and there's this automatic connection. They fall in love. There's this deep attraction. Of course, we already know about Rebekah. She was an attractive young woman. I'm going to assume that Isaac as well. And they just had this mutual attraction for one another, which is important in marriage, okay? Sometimes godly people, believers, feel like, you know, what are you looking for in a marriage partner? And you can't say attraction, right? You got to be like, oh, she's got to be, you know, have faith, character, all this kind of stuff. And you can't. But that's a very important part of this whole mutual marriage. That's attraction is a very important part of that. But here's an advice for you guys, for those who are single. Attraction, don't rely on your first impressions. Attractions can grow on you. If Lydia relied on her first impression of me, oh, we would never get married, right? She said that when she first saw me, right? At age 26, she thought I was 35. She thought I was married with kids and that I had just recently moved to the U.S. from Korea. She was surprised when I spoke English, you know? Boy, was she wrong about her impressions, okay? I had her when I said, turn to Matthew chapter, you know, and I had her, okay? My first memory of Lydia was during a worship service. All right, no, I wasn't checking her out, okay? I wasn't a pastor checking out a girl during worship, okay? But I remember that in that room, that she was clearly the most passionately just worshiping God, and something I still love seeing even now. That was my first impression of her, even though her first impression of me was not too good, okay? Character. There's nothing more beautiful than character and her faith, and that grows on you, right? And so they don't throw away an opportunity just because of that, right? Although I think that is a very important part as well. And so we got these two people that have come together. We got a father who's been praying. We got a son, and we got Isaac, and we got Rebekah of incredible faith. And by God's providence, they meet together. In verse 67, it says, Isaac brought her into the tent of his mother Sarah, and he married Rebekah, so she became his wife, and he loved her. And Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. They get married. They begin enjoying a beautiful love relationship. Now, we don't know how old Rebekah is, but we are told how old Isaac is in the later verse. He is 40 years old when he gets married. Even in the culture back then, that was later than usual. Okay? I wonder when the Bible says that he was meditating in the field and then he came and looks at Rebekah coming, right? I wonder, was he praying for his future wife? He was praying for that? That'd be a cool story if that was true, right? He's praying and then boom, he sees this woman come along. But he's waiting 40 years because he's not willing to compromise. He will wait on the Lord. Abraham will not compromise. She has to have this kind of faith, this kind of character. Like his son later on, I bet he could have found a daughter of Canaan, right? And been married many, many years ago. But he's been waiting. He's been praying. He's been listening to his father's wisdom and knowing his father's prayers, for those who've been praying and longing for God to provide. Continue trusting and waiting. Trusting and waiting. Do not compromise, though, on your future spouse's faith, their relationship with Jesus. Do not compromise on their character. Can all the married people say amen? It's not worth it. It's not worth it. Abraham says, if she won't have that, you release from the vow. I'd rather him stay single for the rest of his life. How God's going to provide a child, who knows? But I'd rather that happen than he gets married to someone outside of the faith, outside of this trust, out of relationship with Jesus, outside of this character. It's not worth it. I just think about my favorite cousin. She got married when she was 40 years old, and for a long time, I mean, my dad was brutal on me. Her parents were brutal on her, and everyone, you know what happens, right? Everyone, every time they meet her, when are you going to get married, right? And so she had to deal with that, and she almost compromised that, and she refused at the end. And then along came this guy at the age of 40, right? A man of incredible character, a man of incredible compassion and incredible faith. Ask her, was it worth the wait and the agony? Especially in the culture, in the Asian cultural setting where she gets just bombarded by these things, right? Yes, it was worth it. Isaac, was she worth the wait? Was Rebecca worth the wait? Absolutely. Absolutely. And then we begin to see the depth of their love for one another. Okay? First, for Isaac. Isaac, who's been grieving the death of his mother, Sarah. As he gets married, Rebecca is there now to comfort and care for Isaac. Rebecca is there comforting and caring for Isaac. We see Isaac being there for his wife. Rebecca suffered from being barren, which in ancient times would have been the harshest thing for a wife, not to be able to bear children. They would not have known this right before because she was a virgin, right? But now that they're trying, she can't bear a child. How difficult and what a strain this could have caused on this marriage. Here's what we find Isaac doing. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebecca became pregnant. Now before you think, based on this verse, they find out she's barren. Lord Jesus, give us a child. Boom, she's pregnant. No. She's 40 when he gets married. He is 60 when the first child comes out. 20 years of prayer. 20 years of suffering for Rebecca. And 20 years of being by her side, praying, crying out on his wife's behalf. I mean, marriages have been strained for much less than this. And here's Isaac, a beautiful picture to me of the longevity of that love through the trials and the tribulations of life, being next to her side, praying, sharing her burden, sharing her tears, just like Rebecca did for him in the grief of his mom passing away. You see this beautiful picture of love and devotion between Rebecca and Isaac and Rebecca. They love one another well, and there's such power in a love that stands the test of time and trials. I mean, it's one thing to love each other and stand by each other when things are going well, right? In life and everything you want. Oh, I got the job that I want. We got the house that we want. We're the kids exactly when we want it. And everything is going well. It's easy, but it's another, whole other thing when the trials and the hardships of life begin to pile up. And then to have someone by your side for 20 years longer who's praying for you, comforting you, encouraging you, rooting for you. That's an incredible gift from God. And if you have that, treasure it. Thank God for it. Thank one another for it. But don't take it for granted. I mean, I can't imagine going through some of the trials in my life and ministry without Lydia by my side, rooting me on, encouraging me, praying for me. And I'm sure many of you feel the same way about your spouse. Knowing a number of your stories, I know you guys have been together through a lot of dark times. What a joy to have someone by your side. What a blessing, someone by your side. Just like Isaac and Rebecca, praying for, carrying each other before the cross, before Christ. Keep doing that. Keep doing that. We see another side to their love. Okay, so we see the depth of their love in terms of how they love one another through the trials and the hardships of life. We see another side of their love story in chapter 26. It's kind of a mixed story. All right, it says, so Isaac selling Gerar, there's a moment when God tells Isaac to go ahead and move with his wife to a different city called Gerar. So he goes there. When the men of the place asked about his wife, he said, "She is my sister," for he feared to say my wife, thinking lest the man of the place should kill me because of Rebekah, because she was attractive in appearance. Man, how hot was she, you know? How beautiful was she, right? That he's thinking, she is so beautiful that if I tell anyone that I'm married to her, they're going to kill me because they want her. So he makes up a story saying, this is my wife. And so here, and we'll see this as we go into next week, you know, the biblical characters, there's depth there, okay? So there's, I've been talking them up, right? But there's also there's wickedness and there's sin and there's duplicity and there's all this stuff, okay? And here Isaac has a weak moment of being so selfish and deceiving, right? Where did his son Jacob learn this from? From his dad, apparently, right? Where did he learn from Abraham, who did something very similar to that. But that's not the point that I want to look at, okay? Verse 8, when he had been there a long time, Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, looked out a window and saw Isaac laughing with Rebekah. Oh, I'm sorry. Looked out the window and saw Isaac laughing with Rebekah, his wife. What's the big deal? So Abimelech called Isaac and said, "Behold, she is not your wife. How then could you say she is my sister?" Isaac said to him, "Because I thought lest I die because of her." Now that's kind of weird, right? Abimelech sees them laughing and thinks, "Oh, they're not sisters. They're not siblings. They're married." I'm like, what kind of laughter, right? What kind of laughter was this? That based on the laughter, he thought, no, there's no way siblings should laugh like that. You know? There's no way brothers and sisters should be laughing that way. They have to be married. Interesting, this is the ESV version's choice of translation of the word laughing. It could also be translated, and maybe your Bibles have this, caressing. In another translation, it says fondling. That's like too graphic, okay? But basically what this guy sees, attracted himself to Rebekah, because she's so beautiful, right? Sees them just in intimate love and caressing and laughing and all that stuff, okay? And he says, there's no way that there's your wife. So I just, again, there's duplicity here. There's all these things that we, you know, things we work through, right? But what I love is I get this picture of marriage from Isaac and Rebekah, enjoying one another, right? Enjoying the gift of intimacy with one another, laughing and caressing and all these things, which is such a gift of marriage, right? At the same time, in the midst of pain, there's this beautiful being there for one another, praying for one another. Oh, what a nice picture, beautiful picture of marriage. And so we get that from Isaac and Rebekah. All right. Well, what Isaac's been praying for 20 years finally gets answered, and Rebekah says, "I'm pregnant. Not just with one, but there's two in my womb." Chapter 25, verse 22, the babies jostled each other within her. All right, these babies now fighting within, right, kind of foreshadowing what's to come. And she said, "Why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples from within you will be separated. Within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger." Rebecca is given this prophecy of what her children in her womb will go to be, that the younger, the one who comes out later, will be the one that is stronger, and the older will serve the younger. So this prophecy is deeply embedded in her mind. I think this explains some of her actions, which we'll talk about next week, okay? But here's my question. One, Did Isaac know this prophecy? Because later on, here's some foreshadowing, right? Rebekah and Isaac wrestle in terms of who to give the blessing to, the older or the younger. And those of you familiar with the story, you know that, right? But I wonder, did Isaac know this prophecy? Did Isaac know that this was going to be God's will? When Mary gets pregnant, right, with Jesus, God reveals through a vision to Mary, but then God also reveals to Joseph. Did God give Isaac this vision as well? We don't read about it, maybe he did. In the very least, I would imagine Rebecca saying, Isaac, I had a dream last night. It was a weird dream. And I imagine at the very least, if Isaac didn't receive this prophecy himself directly from God, that he received it from Rebecca. Rebecca must have told him, this is what the Lord said. Okay, hold on to that, okay? Yeah, hold on to it for a whole week, okay? When the time, verse 24, came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first to come out was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment. So when they named him Esau, they named him Hairy. That was his name, Hairy. After this, that's what Esau means, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel. So he named him Jacob. Jacob could be actually translated grasp, or actually, he has a double meaning, deceiving. Both applies to him. So they named them based on what they observed, okay? And so he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them, okay? So you do the math, 20 years of praying, okay? From the very beginning, from the birth, they were going to be very different, even the way they look. And as they grow, their differences become so clearly evident. Oh, but I'm sure there's so much joy right now. There's so much joy in this family. Oh, all these years of praying to God, and now they have a child. I mean, just as those of you who have children, imagine, you know, go back to that day when in the hospital room or that you gave birth, and what a joy that was of that answered prayer. But as they grow up, man, the differences can't be more starker. The boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter. This will be the last passage we read today. The boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was a quiet man, staying among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Esau, he's a man's man. He's a skillful hunter. He loves the outdoor. He's an extrovert. He has a very deep voice, right? He's very, very hairy. Jacob is a mama's boy. He's an introvert. He's quiet. Not many friends, you know? He clings to his mom. He helps around the house, right? These two can't be more different, right? Esau says, oh, look what I brought today from hunting. And Jacob says, here's my sweater that I made, right? They can't be more different. But anyone with two kids, you can appreciate this, right? How different they are. You wonder, they both came from the same womb? How is that possible? But they're so different. They're so utterly different, right? And these two can't be more different. But in verse 28 is where we see now the dysfunction in this family, even this great family, this loving, godly family with loving, godly parents, we see this dysfunction starting to creep in. It says, Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. I don't think that means that Rebekah did not love Esau and Isaac did not love Jacob, but I think what it is saying is that Isaac loved Esau more than Jacob, and Rebekah loved Rebekah loved Jacob more than Esau. Does that resonate with anyone here? You know? That favoritism? I wonder why. Well, we give one quick explanation. For Isaac, he liked the things that Esau liked, you know? I remember some people telling me, you know, when they found out that I was going to have a boy, how would you feel if your son does not like sports like you do and they want to dance instead, you know? So what kind of question is that, right? Thank God they both love sports. Oh, but so different from him or so similar. And so I could see Isaac just loving to go out with Esau. Maybe they invited Jacob. Hey, you want to come along? No, I want to stay with mom. Okay. And so it's just him and Esau and they're bonding. And I don't think it was deliberate, ill-willed. But over time, it's the guy that he's spending time with, and there's this bond between the two of them. And maybe Rebekah gives more love to Jacob to compensate for the love that was not given to him by the dad. Maybe it was a vision that she had that she held on to, that it's going to be the younger that is going to be stronger than the older. It's going to be the older that serves the younger. So she has that vision, and that biases her to Jacob. Or maybe just like Isaac and Esau, Jacob just spent more time with her, and so she appreciated that, and so a bond began to form there. We don't know. We don't know why one parent favors another, but it happens. And we know that this ancient family, what they experienced, is not unique to modern-day families. You may be able to relate to this. Maybe you grew up in a home where one or both parents favored another sibling over you, and there's pain there. Or maybe you were the favored child. There's pain there as well, as it affects your relationship with your siblings and suffer from jealousy and bitterness. What happened to Joseph and his brothers, right? There's all sorts of danger and pain in this home. Bitterness to jealousy, broken relationships. We see all of these things. And I think as parents, we have to be so careful here. It may not even be reality, right? You love them the same. They're just different, so you treat them differently. But one child perceives it as favoritism, but that perception, however false it is, can have such a lasting effect on a child. I remember for me, I grew up in the second of three boys. I was the middle child, three boys, middle child. They say middle children are the black sheep of the family. Not me, okay? But I grew up and I felt the favoritism, not so much for my parents, but I felt it for my brothers. For some reason, every time we got to an argument, it was those two on one side, it was me fending for myself on the other side. And I could never figure it out until later on. I wondered if because, I wonder if it's because they saw my parents somewhat favoring me over them. And was that the cause of, because I felt this intense disdain for my brothers when I was a young child. I remember feeling very, very lonely because of that, you know? I remember one time, which was interesting, that perception, because I actually thought for a while that it wasn't just my brothers, but my parents who also didn't like me as much as my brothers did. I remember my mom joking around saying that we found you under a bridge. Your nose is so much bigger than everyone in this family, right? And she was joking, I think, right? But for me, I thought, oh my goodness, I came from a bridge. And I had this added proof that whenever any chore needed to get done in the house, she would always ask me and never my brothers. I remember actually confronted my mom and said, Mom, why do you always tell me to do everything, not them? And thinking that this was favoritism over them, right? And my mom said, it's because you're the only one that does it. So you're the only one that does it, you know? But I remember just the perceptions that could be there that brings pain as you grow up. And whether perception or reality, if you felt that, or I know that I was not the favorite, I was favored, and there was jealousy and all this stuff, right? You know that there's pain within family. We will begin to see the devastating effects of this on this family. But, because I don't want to just end right there, right? Which I have to end right now, though, is at the end of it, I'll give you a foreshadowing, at the end of this broken story, of this broken family, for many, many years brokenness, at the very end, there's this beautiful picture of reconciliation and redemption in this family. And I can't wait for us to get to that place at the end of next week's sermon, this beautiful picture that we see. But here's the thing. Out of this broken family, let me end here. Out of this broken family, there's beauty in this family. We've seen that. There's beauty in this marriage, but there's brokenness in this family as well. Out of this is the family that Christ chooses to eventually be born, to be the savior of broken relationships, beginning with our broken relationship with God, but also, as we talked about a few weeks ago, reconciliation and redemption with one another. As we celebrate Mother's Day, as we began with the video earlier today, man, I hope we can just love on our moms, love on those in our church who are moms, who are taking the burden of raising our children. And moms, as you think about this final part of the message and wonder, oh, did I should, instead of being so hard on yourself, right? I think as parents, sometimes we're so hard on ourselves. A couple of your life groups are going through a study right now on parenting. And those who life groups, if you're not going through the study on parenting, you could ask me for it. You could borrow it this summer. It's an awesome study on parenting. But one of the things that it says is, as parents, we need to learn how to give grace to ourselves. We'll talk about this next week. Yeah, I can't fast forward, but I imagine Isaac and Rebecca, after all these things happened, them just beating themselves on the head and saying, why did I? But here's the thing. As parents, we're imperfect. Our God is perfect. And we need to learn how to give grace to ourselves as well. And today, moms, would you just receive and soak in the grace of God? Soak in and let your family just embrace you with love and thanksgiving and soak that in and receive that grace. Close your eyes with me.